There are readings assigned during spring break, which is not allowed. It's against the Geneva Convention, I think, you know. And so so I need to work on that, you know, so that's okay. I'm going to work on that. So anyway, let's finish up our week with a short class on... There's some really interesting content in this chapter 6, which I guess technically we should have talked about on Tuesday. But before we get to that, let's see if there's any food news. Anybody have food news? Yes?
So apparently salmon are naturally just whitefish, and the reason they get their pink or, like, red pigment is from eating krill or, like, shrimps and stuff like that.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
And so when like, farmers do farm salmon, they'll actually add pigment back in because the customers want.
So they don't actually feed them the shrimp that'll make them pink.
They'll either put the pigment in through, like, shrimp flour or something like
that. Oh, interesting.
Or, like, add it in. They'll add it back
Yeah,
in.
Because we expect that color. Yeah. It's a good example. There's other foods where coloring matters enough so that we fake the coloring. That's a good example. That's good. Yeah.
Don't they do the same with red meat? I thought they added red.
I don't know. I thought red meat was red.
Well, I think it's browns quickly, and then they add dye to it to make it so it doesn't brown as quickly. Even though it's not bad, people view the wrapped brown meat as worse or lesser quality. When in reality, it's just...
So does that happen in the store, you think, or in the packing?
I don't know. I would imagine the packaging.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. That would be good to know more about. Absolutely. Food colors are... You know, for a long time, when margarine came out, the dairy industry didn't want it to be colored yellow because it would make it look too much like butter. So you get these food coloring issues like that. Yeah. Good. Others? Yeah. Yes.
I watched a documentary. It was called That Sugar Movie.
Oh, okay.
Super funny, super good. This Australian guy normally eats a paleo diet. Mm-hmm. He tried to do kind of the opposite thing by eating what's considered health foods, like in stores where you can buy, like, the apple juice, all that.
Right.
And the goal was to get the 44 teaspoons, which is the normal Australian amount, in, like, a week. And he wanted to get it from his food, but he was noticing how quickly it adds up. It was really interesting because he wasn't eating, like, candy or anything.
Right,
he was just eating health foods.
Right.
And he just, like, was eating way over.
Good.
He gained weight and had a lot of issues in just a month. It was really
interesting. So there might be, you know, that's interesting. It raises the question of if you could shop from a line of health food and still have an unhealthy diet.
Yeah.
I think that's entirely plausible. Right, yeah.
And then he also came to America and was talking to kids that, like, grew up drinking Mountain Dew, and their teeth have completely rotted out. And, like, they actually show that they couldn't use anesthetic because it's so
their teeth are
messed
sensitive.
Up and dead in there.
Wow. Right. Well, you remember the dental, the moment in which sugar... We're going to read more about this, but we already read a little bit about the dentist who brought all these bad teeth to Washington and as a way of demonstrating against sugar in the early, I think it was in the 70s. Yeah, good. Others? That's a good one. Yeah, it's good that you guys are noticing food details, stuff like that's just great to bring in into class. I had one that's maybe not so interesting, but there's kind of a link to it. I was reading somebody who said that Italian mozzarella, you know, authentic Italian mozzarella cheese is made from buffalo milk. And so this author was saying that there have been milk scandals in Italy where milk and olive oil scandals where a product that says it's made in Italy, which is usually a standard of higher quality, is actually imported from some other country that is not known as for high quality. So this person said that a lot of the mozzarella was actually from buffalo in Southeast Asia, which may or may not be a bad thing, right? But if you've had authentic mozzarella, it's really great, and it does come from buffalo, and there are Italian buffalo. So, but then this article I found said that American entrepreneurs have been trying to make authentic mozzarella in the U.S. from buffaloes, and they've just haven't been able to succeed. So it's kind of an authentic food story. It's an entrepreneur food story. I'm also hoping somebody succeeds. There was somebody in the other class whose family was in farming, and I was going to try and convince them to get into buffalo raising. But I guess with you'd have to have a buffalo and somebody brave enough to. How do you milk a buffalo? I just don't even. This is how remote I am from food. I just. It seems a scary proposition to milk a buffalo, don't you think? They seem to me more violent than cows, but maybe not. Anyway. Okay, let's get into our material. You had one? Yeah.
Yeah, good. I read an interesting fact about salmonella in chicken.
Oh, okay.
And the British have had success with vaccines to reduce salmonella all up in nearly the entirety of their chicken farms and stuff.
Good.
So American FDA, I guess they denied that vaccine.
Huh.
They're not going through the process, even though British had complete success with it.
Yeah.
So our salmonella is avoidable.
Yeah.
Which is kind of bizarre to me that they wouldn't go through. I mean,
Yeah, that's a good food health store.
They didn't have a good reason on to why they didn't. They just didn't believe that it would be successful.
Wow,
that's
interesting.
It was interesting to me that we could just avoid that problem entirely.
Yeah, I want to know more about that. That's good. I mean, countries refuse each other's food science sometimes. Like, Europeans won't, maybe I've mentioned this, Europeans won't allow U.S. meat to be imported to Europe, not since about the 90s, early 90s, because they don't think our meat's healthy. And you know, you can make a case one way or the other. It's not, I don't think commercial meat in the U.S. is going to kill you, but Europeans just won't, they just don't want it. And then there's a story there. I should have more details on that. But that's good. Good food health story. Good. Okay. Okay, let's get into our material. It's only 10 pages. Again, you know, when I originally did this as part of Tuesday's class, or meant this as part of Tuesday's class, I thought, well, I'll truncate the chapter because a lot of the chapter is about patriotic eating, right? So after about 155, it gets into eating in World War I and eating World War II, and those are interesting stories. But when I was trying to compress more reading into our course, I thought, well, I could leave that out. So I won't say much about that part of the chapter. But let's just get some notes together and some think together, really, about the significance of some of the stories in this short part of this chapter, okay? Then we'll be done pretty soon. So I think the question, you know, the question she's asking is, how do Americans use food to express purity, piety, patriotism, and other values? And there's a few good stories here. There's Graham. Sylvester Graham comes out of a temperance society. He's advocating. So you, and one of the cool things about this chapter is instead of reading about Mesopotamia and Rome and you know the Mayflower and Jamestown, we're getting stories now that are 19th century American food culture stories, and I think it's really interesting to notice how even in the 19th century. There was the beginning, this is a good place to start your notes. The 19th century began the process of commercialization of food with canning. So we tend to think of the food industry exploding after World War II, which it did, right? So the really huge explosion in food science-based products, food products, really occurs in after World War II. But make sure you're clear in your notes that even in the 19th century, with canning, it was possible to offer wealthy consumers, even middle-class consumers, a wide range of foods where they didn't have to do as much food production. So you have to remember that prior to stored foods, industrial stored foods, which begins with canning, you would have had to make all of your food from pretty much local ingredients. You might afford some imported ingredients, but for the most part, food was in the early 19th century, food was a much more local affair. So this is important for a couple of reasons, right? Now you can have status you can get social status by not having to eat local food. You can get social status by having a greater variety of food than other people have. And especially women are starting to transition from food producers to food consumers. So it's important to see that as the context. And people like Graham and Kellogg and the Transcendentalists, they regarded this development in commercialization of food as unhealthy. But they also had their own ideas about food health. So let's take a look at Graham's diet. So he's a temperance society guy. At 145, we've got his actual diet advice, right? So he believes in avoiding stimulating foods, no meat, coffee, tea, alcohol, spices, condiments. It's a vegetarian raw foods diet that he's advocating. He he correctly actually criticizes milling practices. He's a whole grain kind of guy, right? He had a lot of weird ideas, including the idea that he didn't think you should put fertilizer in soil. So he had some funny ideas about that, but the main focus here was to eat very plain food. And he actually thought sex, this is kind of one of his weird ideas, thought sex was bad for your health, and eating spicy food would put you on the path to having sex. So he's got this kind of interesting partial health-crazed diet and partly this pious diet about not exciting yourself and so on. And this was not a popular thing initially. You learned that he gave a lecture that had to be stopped. He had to be deplatformed because there were protesters outside. People didn't like the idea of somebody saying that you shouldn't eat meat. And so Graham was kind of an early advocate of a healthy diet. He's also the person who creates the Graham cracker, and then you learn that his diet becomes influential to the shakers. So let's transition into the second segment here. So the shakers have a diet that's based on low meat. The Shakers are a religious community characterized by celibacy. They only grow by conversion. So I think the Shakers are gone now, or they're almost gone. They had a period of time when their numbers were growing because people were converting to this. They lived in separate, the men and women lived in separate buildings. They grew most of their own food. So this is the point for your notes. Graham's diet was a more pious diet than theirs, and Shakers started to like it. And it started to cause dissension among Shakers, because people who adopted the Graham diet told the people who were just following the normal Shaker diet that they were gluttons and hedonists. So the point for your notes is that the diet piety connection becomes a source of divisiveness in this religious community. And that's, to me, that shows just how, and I think to Wallach, that shows just how powerful the connection is between our diets and our commitments to things like purity, religious piety and purity. Some reactions to that? Did you feel the power of that? And it's also interesting that in this chapter we're getting these 19th century vegetarian and sometimes vegan movements. Veganism actually gets its main spokesman in the 20th century. But modern vegetarianism is dated from the 19th century in both the U.S. and in England. And you don't get it quite here. You're going to get this in a little bit later, but with the Transcendentalists. So let's go ahead to them. So the first segment was about Graham's diet and how it influenced the Shakers and causes dissension about what it means to be a pious Shaker. Okay, I think that's most of. I guess I should have mentioned the context here too, because there's more, a little more context here, which is that. That's good. That works. Okay, so then let's take a look at the Transcendentalists. Now, the philosophy majors and minors know Transcendentalists may be connected with, identified with Ralph Waldo Emerson, right? And the Unitarians, it was a philosophical movement related to Unitarianism. Thoreau, Emerson, and others were Transcendentalists. And I don't want to get into their ideas too much. You can look them up, though. It was mostly a philosophical movement, but it also had a social progressive dimension. Transcendentalists were politically liberal, so they were. Here you learn about the literary Transcendentalists, Louisa May Alcott. Her dad. So these are New England Brahmins. They're liberals. They're criticizing slavery. They're abolitionists. They're some of the first people to criticize the treatment of Native Americans in the country. So they're kind of progressive looking. They're critical of inequality in the society. And this is one of many food food-based communes. You guys, if anybody wants to study this, there are lots of food-based communes in the 19th century American culture. And it's an interesting phenomenon. I don't think other countries have so many. And in this one has this great name, Fruitland. So what they did was they decided to try to live off the grid, live off the land. Their dietary beliefs were interesting, and more philosophically developed than Graham's. Okay, so let's track this a bit. So they had this idea that society was corrupt and that this diet was going to be part of a redemption or salvation from this society. So this was a pretty strict diet. No meat, no meat products, no honey. Vegans often argue that honey is exploitative because you're exploiting bees who are making the honey. They were conflicted about whether to use animals to plow fields. Eventually they did. They thought it was exploitative. These are very, if you look historic, whatever you think of these ideas, that's not the point. But in terms of being ahead of their time, they certainly were. I mean, this is stuff that today people, more people, even though a very small number, more people would advocate. So they set up this place called Fruitlands, which has kind of a goofy name. And so they had this is a point for you to notice, they had a philosophical belief that animals were not intended to be food. Notice they didn't cite biblical vegetarianism, but you notice that we have that as a correlate as well. There are a couple more details here. Right. So mostly that they were vegans basically. They didn't want to wear clothes made from animals. That was one of the other details. They expelled this woman for eating a bite of fish. Oh my God! How could you do that? They failed for some reasons that we saw last time with the pilgrims. They failed because they didn't know how to do the work. They didn't know how much land it would take to raise all their own food. They weren't ready to do physical labor. They were a little bit on the intellectual effete side, I think, if you had to say it bluntly. So any thoughts on them? I mean, the basic idea is that, again, you've got not a piety-based, but a philosophically-based food diet, a kind of utopian diet, which includes a critique of the major culture. Yes?
So when you say they failed, they just gave up?
That's a good question. The actual denouement escapes me, but they were unable to do it. They had to fold. And then they started arguing with each other, too. They were not in accord as much as you might need to be. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Others? So why do we want to study these? Just let's see if we can tag the significance of this, because there's some really interesting stories here. I think I find these stories really important because they show how likely it is that people will connect their critiques of a society to a redemptive diet. You see that? I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about food being part of a utopian vision. We've already seen in great depth how it's part of a religious community, how it's part of religious unity, a religious identity. So that's still there. But what's new here is that these are reactions to the beginnings of a commercial food culture. And Graham and the Transcendentalists are both saying, hey, the culture's going the wrong way. We need to recover, and you hear that a lot today. So I think it's interesting to study historical examples of that, because it helps me, I'll just make it personal, it helps me avoid over-recommending my dietary discoveries. Because we all get into our food, our diets, with tremendous psychological commitment, enough that we're willing to set up communes and go off the grid with people to do this, or we're willing to fight over it in Shaker communities, and So food, I just think it's really important to study these examples, because they're kind of warnings about not taking your diet too seriously. Does that make sense? Even though a lot of the course is encouraging you to take your diet very seriously. Okay, the main story here, one of the biggest stories in American food history, is the Kellogg and the Kellogg commercial cereal story, because here you've got not just a drama about pious eating or philosophical eating, you've got the beginnings of the U.S. commercial cereal food industry. This is huge, Okay, so let's just rehearse the story together, see if you have some details to add, and then see what we say about the significance of it. So Kellogg, you learn, is a guy who had his own health issues, he had his own dietary issues, he independently came to vegetarianism, and then he gets sponsored by the founder of the Seventh, any Seventh-day Adventists? I have some friends who are Seventh-day Adventists, I know a Seventh-day Adventist, I shouldn't overstate it. Seventh-day Adventists are interesting, they still hold to a vegetarian, nobody knows of Seventh-day Adventists. Yeah, do you?
I grew up with a kid.
Did you grow up with it, or no?
Oh, like
knowing.
He lived two houses away from me.
Cool, okay.
Yeah, he was a friend.
Yeah, they're still vegetarians. They have a pious diet. I think they don't drink alcohol. I think they might allow some alcohol. But Ellen White was the founder of this religion, and she had these visions about health and diet. And some of the details are kind of interesting. Let's just kind of rehearse those real quick. She gets these visions where she was, an angel commanded her to eat two meals a day, avoid meat, coffee, tea, and alcohol, and to consume whole grain bread. Now, this is an interesting, this is just as roller mills were coming in and people were valuing white bread. This becomes a signal of, see how that's a rejection of an industrial food process? So the whole grain movement doesn't start until, as far as I'm, the whole grain health movement doesn't start until we start producing grain that isn't whole grain and people regard as inferior. So she gets this vision about pious eating, and then she enforces it on her church. She favors Kellogg. She pays for his medical school education, and then when he gets out, he sets up Battle Creek Sanitarium, which he presides over for the next six decades. He's a philanthropic guy. He does all these good works in Chicago, some of them connected with food. But he's very innovative, too. So he has the Graham-like diet with these twice-baked Zwiebacke. Anybody know this? It's a German term for literally twice-baked, right? So these are, if you've ever eaten Zwiebacke, it's just a biscuit. You know, it's kind of, you can make, if you make them, you actually do bake them twice. And it's just a very dry biscuit. Some of them are nice, but it's considered kind of a hearty thing. And the key thing here is that he wants in his sanitarium, he wants people to eat this Zwiebacke, but they don't have good teeth. So they find it hard to chew. So he starts soaking grains, he starts inventing ways to soften them up, and he becomes one of the independent discoverers of granola. So granola, I don't know if he's serving, I think he's serving it the way a lot of people eat today, is with milk to soften it up. And somebody else had invented a kind of granola a little bit earlier, but that's a pretty big invention. He also invents peanut butter. So he's using machines to grind up and soften grains, and he eventually comes to the machine processing of grain. His brother is the commercial guy. They fight in court about commercializing the products, because he's selling these granolas and breads from the sanitarium. And you read that famous people go to the sanitarium. The list includes, you know, J.C. Penney, President Taft, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford. So let's make it clear in your notes that intelligent people, I mean, these are movers and shakers, these are inventors, intelligent people are buying into this critique of the society and society's food system, which is just becoming, and it's just beginning to become an industrialized food system. You see why this is such an interesting moment? And they're saying, no, this can't. That's not the right way to eat. And he's got crazy ideas. He thinks you should. He's like Fletcher, this guy, famous guy Fletcher. He thinks you should chew 30 times for each bite, which is a really gross thing to do. I don't know if you've ever tried it. But when I was growing up, this was still kind of advice, and my parents would say, no, you need to chew your food 30 times before you swallow it. And it was horrible, you know. But fortunately, they weren't strict about it.
I think I'm just a little confused.
Sure.
So the basis of, like, founding this sanitarium was to avoid this industrialization, but then he kind of industrializes anyways.
His brother. Well, so he's an inventor. So yeah, he's bringing machinery into the process because he's trying to create these new things like granola and peanut butter. Then his brother's really the commercial mastermind and fights him. It puts it into and wants to commercialize it. And they fight in court about it because he doesn't want this to happen. See, you see how it goes against. So the brother basically industrializes John Harvey Kellogg's diet.
It's weird that he would like use machines if they're trying to avoid that in the first place. You
know? Yeah, absolutely. But he's against roller mills, which are machines that are going to create white flour for the first time. But it's not a wholesale rejection of industrialization. That's a good point. Yeah, that's good. He's using machines to try to create new whole foods that people could eat healthy. Good, yeah. What is also confusing, though, now that you mention it, is that the industrial products that we get from this moment in history are highly unhealthy. Yeah, I mean, so that's actually one of the ironies of this is that it depends on your nutritional politics, but I do think extruded breakfast cereals are by and large a fraud. I don't think they're really a good value. I don't think they taste as good as other alternatives. That's up to you to discover or agree with or not. But it is an irony if you believe that this unhealthy product grows out of a health food movement, right? Mm-hmm. So it is confusing. Good. That's part of what's interesting about the story. So Kellogg commercializes the cereals, and then Post is another one who comes into the picture, and he starts a rival spa where you can eat meat. So it's kind of like health food. You know, there's always this resistance to, vegetarian diets. They're still not very popular. I think the percentage of people on vegetarian diets is something like 3 or 4%. It's just not huge. Most people really want meat in their diet. And so Post went to the sanitarium, he starts this rival spa, and then, of course, he starts his own commercial cereal. In Battle Creek, Michigan, we had somebody in the other class whose family is, had family back in Battle Creek, and they all grew up with, the cereals are the greatest things in the world. It was part of their family's connection to this industry. And so you might adopt that view if you grew up in Battle Creek. How many of you eat commercialized cereals as part of you like your cereals? Good. Yeah. What do you like?
I like Honey Bunches of Oats a lot.
Yeah, those are great.
With strawberries.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Really? What do you mean? You add your own strawberries?
No, it comes with strawberries. Okay. But I mostly just eat it because it's fast.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
The main reason. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to love my cereals. I think at some point I decided I want something different, but that's one of those things you can experiment with. Yeah. Post had this crazy idea that if you engage in positive thinking about your health, you'd be healthier, which might not be too crazy. I don't know. So do you see what these guys are up to? They're starting to get this idea that the 19th century diet is unhealthy. And I should have mentioned this. Part of what people were eating for breakfast was, it's mentioned in the article, people were eating really meaty, greasy things for breakfast. This is the beginning. We're starting to get wealthier as a country. So there's still food insecurity. There's still a lot of people who don't get their calories. But people are starting to eat heavier breakfasts. And partly these remedies are coming as a response to dyspepsia, which people are reporting. So people are reporting discomfort and ailments from their diet. So there isn't like this comes out of a... It's not just a reaction to the growth of commercial food and canning. It's also a reaction to the actual diets that middle class and wealthy people are eating at this time, which is kind of upsetting their stomachs and their GI tracts. Okay, so can we kind of identify or reinforce the significance of these stories and then call it good? What do you think? How do you guys react to these stories? What do you find interesting about them? What lessons should we take away from them? I've already identified one. Maybe we could start there. One lesson I take from this is that it's more evidence of the way we become invested in our foods psychologically, the way we tend to over-recommend our diets or over-invest our diets with meaning. But it's also significant for me that pure whole food diets start to grow at this time in American history, just as people are starting to experience commercialized food. you could have a broader social critique of that. There's a lot going on in the mid 19th century. Anything else? What do you think?
I think along with that, there's also just such a cultural and almost like, I don't know, isolating component of developing a diet, and all of these communities are very,
that's a good point.
Elite or exclusive, and
yeah.
It's so surrounded by the diet, and that's the way that a lot of groups can identify themselves, whether it's religious or cultural.
Yeah, so it could be good. That's really good. So there's a sense of group identity, whether you're an intellectual who joins in this intellectual critique or you have a religious commitment. That's part of the mix, part of what makes diet so important is this idea that it's going to unify a group of people, or it's going to help me identify that I'm one of the people who knows that this isn't good, what the rest of you are doing. So when you think about the piety of people who have really good diets today that are really healthy but not mainstream, you can kind of see the same thing. They build identity around their intellectual consensus that this is a smart diet. Yeah, good. Others? I think we're getting the significance. I don't know if there's that much more to pull out of this.
Yeah.
I kind of thought it was interesting here. You said the people that grew up in the cereal place just kind of adopted the views where they grew up.
Yeah. So the student in the other class reported that, you know, the loyalty to the cereal industry is pretty strong in her family, just because she has this grandparent who's connected to it. Yeah, that is interesting, yeah. This is the biggest lesson for me. It makes me want, it reminds me not to over-hype my own dietary discoveries, because I like my dietary discoveries. I'm encouraging you guys to make dietary discoveries, and that those are highly personal. I think they can be informed by lots of information. We're gonna dive into nutrition science after the break. So I think on the one hand, I want this course to help encourage you to take diet seriously and to make discoveries along the lines of nutrition, taste, and practicality. But I also think these are reminders to me not to be generous to the person who loves their diet. So I have vegan friends who are just all about their vegan diets, right? It's easy to tease vegans about that or to joke about people who have those diets, because they're diets that take a lot of energy to maintain. There's a strong human desire for meat and meat products. And I don't necessarily think that, I think it's a philosophical question whether you choose meat or not, but I don't think it's one that I would ever, you know, say that somebody was a bad person for choosing to eat meat or not eat meat. But there's a tendency to do that. There's a tendency to think that if you're following a pure diet that's based on a really deep critique of the rest of the world, that you're going to believe in it. You're going to invest in it. You know what I mean? I mean, I think my friends who won't eat fish because the fish are being overfed, and they won't eat meat because meat often involves a lot of suffering, I think that's noble. But that kind of piety about your diet can easily kind of go too far, right? I mean, it's a complicated topic. We're going to get into food ethics in April, and we'll do more thinking about that.
I didn't grow up Seventh-day Adventist, but I grew up in a Mormon family.
Okay, great.
I've since left the church, but...
Do Mormons have any dietary?
Yeah.
Well, it's like no alcohol, no tea, no coffee.
So that's the things that most people know about, just like no alcohol, no tobacco, no illegal drugs,
right.
No coffee, no tea. And then lots of Mormons in for, like, oh, I better not drink any caffeine.
Okay.
Because there's no coffee and tea.
Right.
Which is actually just, there's nowhere that says that.
Oh, you can have caffeine. Okay.
You can't have caffeine, which is, most people don't realize that.
So some Mormons might avoid
Mormons.
Caffeine and sodas, for example.
They usually just avoid it altogether. But from my experience, Mormons don't follow that diet because they believe in it and believe in the health effects as much as that they want to be worthy.
Right.
And
right.
they're worried about what will happen if they don't follow it.
Right.
And yet, it's really interesting because the only reason, the original doctrine just said no hot drinks. Because I can't remember who it was.
Maybe
the
they
prophets
were stimulating?
Thought that, yeah, there was something wrong with hot drinks, and that's where coffee and tea came from, because those were the hot drinks around at the time.
Yeah, right.
And
that's
then
cool.
It kind of turned into this caffeine thing.
Neat.
And it's kind of, like, changed over time. But
would Mormons look down on each other for violating? Like, if you were caught coming out of a bar, would Mormons?
Oh yeah.
That would be bad.
You would lose your temple recommend.
Yeah. Okay.
There's some pretty big consequences.
Wow. Okay, that's good to know.
I was interviewed, probably bi-weekly, and asked that I was following all of the regulations.
Yeah. That's really interesting. That's good.
Yeah.
You're reminding me that I grew up with, as a Catholic, I grew up with these dietary restrictions. We didn't eat meat on Fridays. Did any of you observe religiously based dietary restrictions in your upbringing? What? No, you kept...
Well, mostly like, observed during Lent.
Right.
Yeah, I only...
Right, oh, right, that's right. Right. I think modern Catholics tend, contemporary Catholics tend to focus on Lent, then, right? Yeah.
My parents are Eastern
Orthodox. Oh, great.
So it's like Lent on steroids.
Like, what did you have to do?
Well, you essentially become vegan.
Is that right?
Like,
during
there
Lent.
Is a period that's very similar to Lent that has a different name.
Yeah.
Sometimes Easter is on the day.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, they're super intense about it. And then, like, on Fridays, we eat fish and, like, vegetable oil.
They're anti-oil.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
My dad's Jewish.
Uh-huh. Great. Lots
and
of dietary.
For like a long time, he didn't eat pork and fish and stuff. He does now. But like when we've done like Passover season and stuff, and like all of the different foods that are used in like tradition for that.
Right. Does he set during Passover? Does he separate dairy and meat in the kitchen and stuff, or?
He's lactose intolerant.
Okay, so that's not an issue. Good.
But
yeah, that's right.
His family, a lot of his family follows that a lot more strictly.
This is good, guys. I hadn't thought of task. I mean, there's obviously a lot of religious vestiges or religiously based diet here. Yeah.
Yeah, one thing that I didn't mention is
sure.
Mormonism also does have, like, other doctrine on diet recommendations, like limit the red meat you eat.
Oh,
that kind of stuff. So I do think that there's a lot of health benefits from following like a Mormon diet, and I think there's a lot of health benefits from not like using any addictive substances like caffeine or alcohol or drugs.
Right.
But yeah, at the same time, I always just found it interesting that nobody focused on those recommendations. That they only focused on those things that they could not eat.
Right.
And that was really
only the prohibition. More on the prohibitions.
Like,
right.
As long as you're not eating those things.
Right.
Like, you could still probably enjoy, like, a nice steak and from time to time and not feel bad about it.
Yeah, so you saw this in our story here, that a diet can be pious, but it can be too strict for people to follow. So you can, it doesn't surprise me that Mormons might be pick and choose and maybe focus on the prohibitions,
mm-hmm.
which are
absolutely
a little bit easier to, they're bright lines in the sand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than sort of the recommendations. But you're also reminding me that, you know, I mean, if I were to get pious about my diet, I'd tell you that, I do still eat animal products, but not meat. And, this is what people call clean eating. It just feels cleaner, you know, I like it. But that's a subjective preference. I would try to always chasten myself from trying to say, oh yeah, if you don't follow that, you know, you're wrong, you're a bad person, you're not thinking correctly. You know, I think that's going too far. We even love our unhealthy diets. So I think if you have if you love the Western diet, okay, you know, you might get some diseases, you might die young, you might get diabetes. You know, that's fine. Those are trade-offs. I mean, I have a cigar once in a while, you know, give me a break. So we all choose our poisons, and we all choose what we want to feel good about, being pure about. And so anyway, that's kind of where I... Did you have something? No? Okay. Good additional thoughts, guys. Thanks a lot for that. Okay, let's break now. If you want to stick around because you're working on a project or you have an idea for a project, let's talk about that. I'm not in a hurry, but thanks for your attention.
Are you doing anything fun spring break?
Not until my grading's done. Yeah, I'm going to try to keep my son. Maybe we're booked. I haven't seen him.
There you go.
How much is it? I'm going
to Grand Canyon.
How exciting.
Then I'm going to go down to San Diego.
Yes. Yeah, great. Good deal.
Have a good spring break.
Yep, take care.